welcome to the Essential Tennis Podcast. If you love tennis and want to improve your game, this podcast is for you. Whether it's technique, strategy, equipment, or the mental game, tennis professional Ian Westerman is here to make you a better player. And now, here's Ian.
Hi, and welcome to episode number 12 of the Essential Tennis Podcast. If you love tennis, then this podcast is for you. We're here because through good advice and through your own hard work, you can improve at the sport that you love. And that's the exciting part about the Essential Tennis Podcast. Throughout the weeks and now months that I've been doing this, more and more people are improving their game. They're becoming better tennis players through getting good advice and going out and working hard and implementing that advice into their game. And now we're building a community of improving tennis players who love the sport, and it's very exciting for me to see. This podcast is for you. If you're listening to this podcast, it's dedicated to you and everybody else who's been listening. All the content for this podcast comes from listeners, and so it's very literally for the listeners. If you have a question about your tennis game, whether it's technique or strategy or equipment or the mental game, send it over to me by going over to EssentialTennis.com, and you too can become part of the show by having your question answered. A couple announcements here before we get to the content for this week. First of all, if you guys have been listening to the last few weeks of the Essential Tennis Podcast, you'll know that I've been talking about the book Mental Tennis by Vic Braden. It's my favorite tennis book and a book that's helped me a lot in my tennis. Well, I now have several copies of it available on EssentialTennis.com. And if it's something that you're interested in taking the time to read, I know it'll be beneficial to your game. If you love tennis and you compete, or even if you don't compete and you just go and play a lot, it's just full of excellent information, and I know it'll be a help to you. So to get a copy, go to EssentialTennis.com/ProShop, or just go to EssentialTennis.com, click on Pro Shop on the top of the page. Now, I made available an offer first to the people who subscribe to my newsletter, and I said the first 5 people to purchase a copy would get a free set of Strain. I've been giving away sets of Head FXP Power, which is a multifilament synthetic gut and has good touch and control. Well, I've sold 2 so far since I sent that email a couple days ago. So anybody else out there who would like a copy of this book, which I highly recommend, the next 3 people to place their order through the website will also get a free set of Strain. So head on over there if you'd like a copy, and I'd be happy to send you some Strain as well, along with your book. Lastly, before we get to the content, I wanted to talk briefly about my newsletter. It's a weekly newsletter that I send via email, and I want to encourage you guys to sign up for that by going to EssentialTennis.com, and on the right side of every page, there's a link that says newsletter sign up. Simply click on that and follow the instructions. There's a lot of benefits to signing up for that. First of all, you get first access to new content. When I do a podcast or a blog or an equipment review, I send an email out every week when those things are completed, telling you guys that are subscribed to the newsletter what the new content is, so that you get a little sneak preview of all the new content up on the website, and you can see what can be most beneficial to you and go right to it instead of having to look around every week and see what's new. Secondly, you get first access to special offers like the one I just described with the free Strains. I've been giving away offers and free things to those people first, because they're the people who have been most active in helping me build Essential Tennis. So you'll get special offers like the free Strain deal first before I make an announcement on the podcast. And lastly, you can help shape Essential Tennis. I plan on asking the opinion of the people who have signed up for it through a couple surveys coming up for anybody who would like to take the time to do it. I'm going to be adding more features as we keep going on Essential Tennis, and I'm always interested to hear back from the people who have been supportive to me and who have been most active as I continue to work on the content and on EssentialTennis.com. Okay, one more thing before we get to the content. I almost forgot. This week I'm also announcing the Essential Tennis Gear Review, and it's a new feature on the website. I have now joining me Jeremy Plumley. He's a master racket technician, and he's now doing reviews of rackets, of strains. He's here on the website now to help you guys with choosing the right equipment for you. Equipment is what he does. He's an expert at equipment. He is the hard goods manager for one of the best country clubs in the country, and he just lives and breathes equipment. Strains, shoes, rackets, clothing. It's what he really loves to follow. It's his passion. And he already has a couple of great articles up on EssentialTennis.com. So head on over there to check those out. And if you have any specific questions for Jeremy or an idea for an article that you would like to see about tennis equipment, then send me a note and I'll pass it along to him. And this is another way that you guys can get good information to improve your tennis. Okay, let's go ahead and get to the content now for Essential Tennis Podcast number 12. Like I announced last week, we have a special guest today on the podcast. His name is Jack Kripsak. He's a medical doctor, and he specializes in sports medicine. I got several great questions from listeners last week about sports medicine and their games, and Dr. Kripsak is here to answer those questions. So, Dr. Jack Kripsak, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ian. It's great to be on. I've enjoyed listening to your shows over the past few months, and I'm excited to be able to interact and hopefully get some good information out to people about the sports injuries, particularly related to tennis.
Yes, absolutely. And I feel like this is going to be a very important topic for our listeners, because what could be more important than staying healthy? You know, it's going to be very difficult to enjoy tennis and go out and play it and work on it if our body is not in good shape. So I think that the information you're going to bring today is going to be excellent, and I hope all the listeners out there appreciate the time that you've taken to come on the show and answer some questions.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and I'm happy to answer questions. I love to give lectures both from a teaching perspective to residents and other physicians, non-sports medicine-related physicians, to teach them, and also to the lay public. So I love to educate, and this is just really a fun thing for me to embark on doing with you.
Great. Well, I'm looking forward to it a great deal as well. Well, the first question I have for you is, please just tell us a little bit about your background in working with athletes in the medical field.
Sure. I'm in small multi-specialty group located in New Jersey in a town called Bridgewater. And I am a board-certified family practice physician, and I am also board-certified in sports medicine. It's called a CAQ, or Certificate of Added Qualifications in the field of sports medicine, which I obtained over 10 years ago and then recertified every 10 years, and I did that a couple years ago also. My association is that I take care of several local high schools, and I am kind of a special consultant to Rutgers University Sports Medicine Department. I'm on the New Jersey State Interscholastic Athletic Association Medical Advisory Board. I also sit on a board for head injury or a concussion program in the state of New Jersey for sports-related concussions. And I am the director of sports medicine for my hospital, Somerset Medical Center, located in Somerville, New Jersey.
Okay.
So that's all right. That's a little bit. How's that?
Yeah, that's great. Well, thanks very much. My second question for you is, do you work mostly with amateur athletes or professional athletes? What's the ratio like?
It's 95% amateur athletes, I do have a few professional athletes that I deal with, but they're in the minority and they kind of come in and out of town. So I don't get to see them as much. I do have some retired athletes. Also along that line, I work with a group called the Living Heart Foundation, which is a cardiovascular study group with the NFL Players Association and the Mayo Clinic. So I get to deal a lot with actually retired football players, which is pretty neat. It's a nice experience dealing with them. And as far as in my day-to-day practice, certainly a lot of recreational junior high school, collegiate athletes I take care of in all sports. I see the gamut. There's tennis, there's golf, football, soccer, lacrosse, ice hockey, basketball, track and field. Pretty much if there's a sport, I'm getting patients with injuries or ailments or questions related to any sport you can imagine.
Okay, cool. Well, lastly, I'm just wondering, tell us a little bit about your tennis playing, because I know that you're a tennis enthusiast as well, and it's a sport that you love to do. Tell us a little bit about your background as a player.
All right. I didn't really play much tennis until I got to medical school. I had played basketball and lacrosse in high school and a little bit of basketball in college. And then when I went to medical school, this one hospital that I was rotating through in Clearwater, Florida, where I eventually did my family practice residency, the hospital had tennis court time at a local tennis club from 8 to 10. And the residents and students and attendings would go down there and play. And so I started finding it as a very nice social avenue, because you get to rub elbows with the attendings, and I just started enjoying playing. So as time went on, and I spent more time in Florida, I started taking more lessons and picking it up, and just fell in love with it, because it was a sport that with my schedule, I had time enough to play. It was easy enough to get a pickup game. All you had to do was call one or three people to get a game of tennis. I didn't have to worry about pickup basketball games, and pickup lacrosse games were becoming a thing of the past, or playing in leagues where my hands were getting too beat up. And so I really just fell in love with tennis. It was great time-wise. It's great exercise. Work with great sweat, burn up a few calories, get a little competitiveness in there, a great way to stay in shape. And also by playing, it would always motivate me to get to the health club to stay in shape so that I can continue to do well in tennis, so that I was always on as top of my game that I could be. And I'd say I'm about a 4-0 player. I play in some leagues here in New Jersey at a local club. Where I live, there's tennis courts, and I have people out on the weekends to play. So I'd say that was my tennis experience.
Okay, great. Well, I have a couple great questions here from our listeners. What do you say we get started?
Let's get after it.
Okay, great. Question number one comes to us from Charles L. He writes and says, what kind of exercises should one do for tennis? Didn't Pete Sampras use a medicine ball or plyometrics? How can one avoid common injuries due to tennis? So Charles is wondering different exercises to avoid injury.
That's a great question. One of the very first things, and Ian, I know you're going to appreciate that, this is to avoid injuries, the first thing you should have is good form and good technique. You should hit your ground strokes well, forehands, backhands, because if you have poor form, you apply unnatural stresses on your joints. So form is everything. For instance, if you were to go join a health club, and you hadn't worked out before, or you were starting on a new set of equipment, the first thing the instructors would do would be to teach you proper technique on the machines, say a Nautilus or a Cybex or whatever. They're not necessarily going to get you out there and have you lifting as much as you can to build strength. The first things you want to do are what's called neuromuscular training. You have to train the nerves that run from your brain to the muscle fibers to contract in the way that you want them to during the stroke. And then with a proper stroke and proper form, you alleviate undue tension and therefore cut down on your risk of injury. I'm sure you've seen this so many times. When someone goes to hit a topspin, they come over the top of the ball and rotate their elbow and their wrist down. The ball inevitably goes flying into the net, and they wonder why their elbow's always sore. And you know the correct way is get that nice brush on the ball and lift it up, and it's a smoother stroke. An important thing with this injury prevention is what we call the kinetic chain, which I'm sure you're familiar with, where where you coil and then uncoil, where the forces start at your feet and then rotate through your legs, your waist, your hips, your torso, and then finally the follow through with your arm. So with this smooth kinetic chain, you produce less strain on any of your joints because, for instance, like a baseball player, a baseball pitcher doesn't get all his strength from throwing his fastball with his arm and his shoulder. He gets it from his legs, his hips, his torso, as that whole chain uncoils. So proper form is so, so important. That will really help cut down on a lot of injuries, the elbow injuries, the shoulder injuries. That's very, very important. And then as far as training, again, I know something you've often talked about is proper footwork. If you can keep your feet light and moving and be able to react and get to a ball quickly and be able to move your feet to get into proper position with slight little adjustments, that's really, really important because as a match goes on and if your feet get tired and you don't have good footwork, you're going to sprain an ankle, you're going to twist a knee, and this is going to lead to injury. So good form is paramount. Having proper footwork is paramount. And then you should try to stay strong. Hit the weights a couple times a week, do some strength training, always remembering to keep a balance. Whenever you exercise one muscle group, you must exercise the antagonistic or opposite muscle group. For instance, if you do a bicep curl, you have to do a tricep extension. If you do an abdominal crunch, you must do a back extension. If you do leg extensions to strengthen your quadriceps, you should do a hamstring curl to strengthen your hamstrings. Every joint must maintain a proper balance of musculature. Otherwise, the joint will be moved out of position and undue forces and tendon strains will occur on that joint, and you'll come up with what we call overuse injuries when you're trying to go out and do things that your body's not properly aligned to do. And as far as some of the footwork stuff, and as far as talking about plyometrics are a great form of training to increase foot speed and acceleration. But you have to be careful with plyometrics because it's a lot of jumping. It's a lot of stress on the joints. So typically, you don't, especially when you're starting out, you don't want to do maybe more than 70 to 100 touches. And what I mean by a touch is if you jump and land in these exercises, every one of those jump and lands is a touch. So you really don't want to go more than 100 touches per session. And you want to make sure you do some strength training at least 2 to 3 weeks beforehand. Otherwise, you will for surely get overuse injuries. Because the tendon in the ligaments in your knees and your ankles and your hips will just not be ready for this kind of trauma because it is a trauma on the body and you'll definitely end up with what we call overuse injuries.
Okay, so would you recommend then that since the core is most important, should we start with strengthening the core, or as we go out and work out to strengthen our bodies, should we be trying to strengthen everything at once together?
You always start with the core. You need good core strengthening because without that, it's like trying to build a house without a foundation. You need strong abdominal muscles, strong back muscles, strong chest muscles, and then from there, once you've developed a good core, then you go on and you strengthen your shoulder, doing a series of internal and external rotation exercises, which we can go into more detail in the future about. You want to build up your forearms, which are particularly important to tennis players. You want to make sure that your legs are strong, that you practice good balance techniques. Things like that are very, very important, but you have to have a good core foundation of strength before you can proceed on to doing other things. So you don't want to run to the gym and start doing bicep curls and leg extensions and leg presses and say, I'm all buff, because that's just not going to cut it.
Sure. Okay. Well, in that case, since the core is most important, can you please give Charles and everybody else some recommendations for good core strengthening exercises?
Oh, sure. One would be, first of all, probably the best thing to do for core strengthening is go out and buy a physio ball. You may see them at the gym, those big rubber balls that you blow up and you do sit-ups and extensions on. They cost about $20, $25. You can pick one up. And there's a little book called the Great Body Ball Workout Book. And let me just preface this also by saying, Ian, that all these items during the course of our conversations that I may recommend to your listeners, mm-hmm. I have no financial interest in. So in other words, I'm not promoting any products that I will be getting any royalties on. These are products that I have found over the course of my years of experience in the field of medicine and sports medicine that I have found very valuable recommending to my patients. But again, no financial interest in any of these.
Okay.
So the Great Body Ball Workout, I think it's like a $78 book. It's a little small paperback. It's got a green cover to it with, I think, a red, blue, and yellow picture or ball on the front. And if you go in there, there's core exercises, and there's about 8 or 10 of them, doing sit-ups with the core ball, and doing hip extensions, hip raises, side-to-side rolls, things like that. It's hard to describe in this setting. Certainly, the pictures tell 1,000 words, and if they go pick up that, it's a minor investment and well worth every dollar they can spend.
Okay, great. Well, Charles, thanks very much for the great question. Hopefully, that answers your question fully. Let's move on to question number 2. And this question is from John in Santa Clara, California. He says, what do you recommend for food consumption before, during, and perhaps even after a match? Water, sports drinks, bananas, etc. Specifically, what purpose does each have, i.e., is it to prevent fatigue, injury, etc.?
This is great. This is a question that comes up all the time, and I love to answer this. We're going to talk about two things here. First, we're going to talk about fluids and hydration. Second, we're going to talk about some nutritional concerns. With fluid and hydration, it's paramount to stay hydrated. And if you don't stay hydrated, you're going to end up with leg cramps. You're going to get tired and fatigued. There are studies that have shown that if you dehydrate by 1%, your body's performance will be off by 5%. If you dehydrate by 3%, you will lose over 20% of your performance ability. There was a study done at Penn State a few years ago, and they had basketball players do specific drills. In one group, they let freely hydrate. In another group, they didn't let drink at all. And the group that freely hydrated on their foul shots and jump shots had a much higher percentage of field goals made than the group that was dehydrated. So it's very, very important to stay hydrated, drinking fluids before you play to load up, and then during your match. You know, toughing it out and not drinking is just going to decrease your performance without a doubt. Not only does it impair your physical activity, it will impair your mental concentration and your mental ability. You won't be able to be as mentally sharp. And I'll just throw this one out to you, Ian, because I know we had mentioned this in the past. My tennis pro that I have here in New Jersey, a guy named Bruce Wild, has told me that one of the successes to tennis is control yourself, control the ball, control your opponent. And if you're dehydrated and can't control yourself, you're going to have a hard time controlling the ball or your opponent. So, and then what kind of sports drink should you drink? Should it be water? Should it be fruit juices? Should it be a sports drink like Powerade or Gatorade or one of those? People always ask me about that, and it's very interesting. Say about 10 years ago, there was a very nice study down at the Olympic Training Center in Colorado, and they lined up a bunch of elite athletes, and they put them on stationary bikes, and they checked through their intestines how much fluid was absorbed into their bloodstream. Because this is really what you want to have. You want to have the fluid in your bloodstream so that your heart doesn't have to pump as hard. The less fluid in your body, the harder your heart has to pump, the more calories you burn up, the faster you're going to fatigue. So you got to keep your body hydrated to keep the stress on your heart down. So they gave one group of cyclists water to drink. They gave one group sugar water to drink. They gave one group salt water to drink, and the last group sugar salt water to drink. And they found that the sugar salt water group absorbed the water the quickest into their bloodstream. And it was felt that the combination of the sugar and the salt created a little electrical charge which drove the fluid through the small intestine and into the bloodstream. And that's what was absorbed the quickest, which is why the sport drinks are so very important. It's not even so much about, you know, Gatorade always talks about fueling and energy and electrolyte replacement. Well, that may be true afterwards, but while you're competing, you need to stay hydrated, and those fluids get into your system the quickest, and so I find them to be the best hydrating substances. And it doesn't really matter which product you go with. I mean, they all pretty much work the same. They all have pretty much the same amount of electrolyte solution. Some of them have a little more for the crampers in the hot weather, but they all have about a 6% sugar solution. Now, some people will say that it's a little thick for them. They don't like the taste. You can cut it, say, 30 to 50% with some water, dilute it down, and you'll still get a good effect from that. In the beginning of the season, is somebody that lives in the north, northeast, northwest, wherever, and they're not used to being out in the heat and playing, the first couple weeks that they get out, they have to what we call acclimatize. Their body's not going to be used to the heat, so they're going to sweat more profusely, and their sweat's going to be more concentrated with sodium, and that's going to take about 2 weeks to correct if the temperature goes up by more than 10 degrees. So for a lot of my patients that are crampers, I have them put a quarter of a teaspoon of salt into their Gatorade for the first couple weeks they're out playing, and that really helps cut down on their cramps. Another little trick I do with my high school football team around here is during their summer practices, we make them drink a bottle of Gatorade every night before they go to bed and a bottle of Gatorade every morning for breakfast, and that really helps cut down on dehydration and cramping also.
Okay. So let's say I have a match tomorrow. When exactly should I start to drink and to hydrate? What kind of plan should I have to get my body ready for a match I might have for the next day?
You should, well, that morning I would have, say you have a 2 o'clock match. For breakfast that morning, 8, 9 o'clock, have a 16-ounce bottle of Gatorade. 2 hours before the match, have about 16 to 24 ounces. A half hour before, have another 8 ounces. And then every 10 to 15 minutes, have a 4 ounces while you're playing. You know, when you take your breaks, you know, on change of sides, you know, have a little 4 ounce shot of Gatorade for yourself, you know, or whatever you feel you need to replenish your thirst.
Okay, great. Well, now let's move on to the food part of his question. What kind of foods do you recommend to eat to prepare for a match?
Complex carbohydrates. They're the source of energy. Carbohydrates are the fuel for muscle. So you want to have carbohydrates, and you want to have a nice complex carbohydrate meal about 2 hours before your match. And those are going to be things like pasta, whole wheat breads, rice, something along that order. You want to stay away from the simple carbohydrates, which are sugars, like refined sugar, candy bars. Power bars tend to be a little high in sugar. They may help if you feel a little lightheaded, but I'm not sure you want to make that your nutritional staple. And you want to stay away from fats because fats are hard to digest. You want to stay away from dairy products. Dairy products are hard to digest. So you want to have approximately a 70% carbohydrate meal about 2 hours before your match, and that's going to give your digestive tract time to get the food through the stomach and into the small and large intestines, so it's not sitting on your stomach where blood will get shunted to your stomach and then it's going to be taken away from your active muscles. You want that blood going to your muscle. You don't want it sitting in your stomach digesting food. So you want to go 2 hours before your match to have your last food and then just continue to hydrate up until that point. And then after a match, again, you want to replace the calories that you've consumed during your match. So you want to have a good carbohydrate meal and add some extra protein in there. I'd say maybe a 60% carbohydrate meal with 20% protein in it, and then the other 10% can be fat. Whey protein has been shown to be an excellent source of muscle repair, a source of nutrient for muscle repair and muscle strength after you exercise. So a good shake with some whey protein powder in it, maybe some bananas, fresh fruit, something like that would be great with, afterwards a slice of pizza or a big bowl of pasta, something along those lines.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for the answer. And John, hopefully that answers your question. If you have any further questions for the doctor, please just send me a note. And next time we have him on, we'll get everything else answered for you. All right, on to question number 3. We still have 2 more questions here. Here's our third one. This is from Bruce in Florida. Bruce writes and says, I am 55 years old and playing singles almost every day. I am in good physical condition and have run 2 marathons. My only physical problem is soreness in my ankles and Achilles area, particularly in the early mornings the day after I play. I have never had a significant injury or sprain. Any suggestions?
Sure. I see a lot of this in my practice. Bruce probably shuffles towards the bathroom in the morning like Fred Sanford until he gets warmed up. The condition here is probably an Achilles tendinosis. You've heard about tendinitis, and the difference here being that a tendinitis is an acute injury of the tendon where your tendon will be injured and there'll be a lot of inflammatory cells in the tendon tissue, and you'll take anti-inflammatories like ibuprofen to cool it down, and then it resolves and it gets better. But with repetitive injury to a tendon over time, it becomes arthritic. So the difference is a normal tendon is going to be like a rubber band. It stretches and recoils nicely. It has that nice elasticity to it. Over time, with the tendinosis and the scarring and the arthritis of that tendon, it becomes like a dried out piece of shoe leather, which doesn't stretch very well anymore. So when you go to stretch it, you're pulling these scar tissue fibers that are degenerated in the tendon, and so you elicit pain. So in this instance, what we want to do is there's a course of treatments that you can go with. The first is very easy, and it's something called eccentric training or eccentric stretching. And Bruce, what I would have you do, or any of your listeners that suffer from this kind of problem, is stand up on a step in your house, on the balls of your feet, and then stand on your toes, do a toe raise with both of your legs, with both of your feet, and then we'll start, and you'll keep the right leg planted, bend your left knee up so that it's off the ground, maintaining your balance on your toes on the right foot. You can hold onto a wall or a banister or whatever to keep your balance, but just stay supported on the balls of your feet for a second or two, and then slowly lower your foot down over the edge of the steps so that the heel drops over the edge and drops down, and you stretch it. Then once that happens, put your left foot back on, raise yourself up with both toes, lift the left leg up, and then lower yourself with the right one. And do that 15 times, both with the knee straight and then with the knee bent, to stretch both the Achilles and the soleus muscles. You might correlate this with when you go to a health club, your trainer might say, hey, we're going to do negatives today, where he'll lift the weight up for you and then you slowly lower it against the stress so that it's easy to come up, but it's hard to go down. And in this way, you strengthen the fibers as you stretch them. So what you're trying to accomplish here is strengthening up your calf muscles while you're stretching that Achilles tendon and actually trying to rip up some of the scar tissue in there, and then it would regenerate. If this alone doesn't do the trick, and by the way, in these instances, taking all the anti-inflammatories in the world probably will not help. You may get a little pain relief, but it's really not going to cure the problem because it's no longer an inflammatory problem, it's an arthritic problem. Tylenol would probably work just as well for any pain that you would have as well as an anti-inflammatory would, and you're probably more likely to get a stomach ulcer taking ibuprofen every day, so I wouldn't recommend that. Another thing you can do is a tension night splint, where you sleep with your foot bent at a 90-degree angle, so with your toes straight up in the air if you're sleeping on your back. Most people, their feet will what we call plantar flex, or their toes will come down. And if you sleep with your foot bent at 90 degrees, then you're going to stretch that tendon while you're sleeping, and again, you'll break up some scar tissue in there and allow the tissue to regenerate. You'll get some bleeding in the area, new regenerative cells will come in, and you'll heal on your own. There's a company called Dynasplint, and you can go to dynasplint.com, dynasplint.com, and you can find someone in your area that works with this. You can usually need a prescription from your physician, and a therapist from the company will come out and fit you for the splint and get you set up, and it works very, very nicely. Some other things, if there's some imbalance in his feet, say, Bruce, if you're a little flat-footed or your ankles roll in a little bit, some custom orthotics may help to correct some biomechanical imbalances in your feet. A great product that we have is something called FootMax, where you walk over a computerized pad and it takes an image of your foot. So it's not just putting your feet into a plaster mold. You get both a dynamic and static evaluation of your feet. They work nice. I make them for the athletes here at our state university, and they absolutely love them. And for most professional athletes, use this brand of orthotics, and they really, really work well. And that's FootMax with two X's at the end.com. You can find someone in your area that makes those, and you can get an evaluation. It's not that you have to buy them, but it's reasonable to at least get an evaluation to see if a biomechanical problem is contributing to this. Another therapeutic modality that you can do is low-energy shockwave therapy. I don't know if you're familiar with when you have a kidney stone, you go get it blasted with a shockwave and it pulverizes the kidney stone and then you pass it. Well, you can do the same thing with tendinoses. Now, it's FDA approved for plantar fasciitis, which is the tendinosis on where you have the heel spurs, but it's also useful for tennis elbow, for jumper's knee, and for an instance like this with a chronic Achilles tendinosis. It's the same principle. You go in and you pound it with a shock wave. You traumatize the area. You cause the tissue to bleed, which stimulates blood flow and regenerative cells to infiltrate the area, and then it goes back from being the dried out piece of shoe leather to more of an elastic rubber band. And then finally, something called prolotherapy or proliferative therapy, which is the injection of a sugar water mixture into the tendon or ligament, whichever is affected. And again, this helps irritate the area, causing blood flow and regenerative cells to come in. So it's all kind of the same principle, and there's just different ways that you can go about doing it.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for the information. And Bruce, hopefully that answers your question. Let me know if you have anything further. All right, our last question today for Dr. Jack comes from Tomas. He's in Florida. He says, I have always wondered if there is a good way to prevent injuries in tennis by proper warm-up technique, in particular, when you are a not-so-young tennis player like myself. You have anything to suggest? So basically, Charles L. earlier asked about exercises to avoid injury off the court. And now Tomas is wondering, how can we warm up properly to avoid injury right before we play?
Sure. And I think we've touched on some of the injury prevention already with one of the prior questions. But a nice warm-up, one thing we like to do with the facility I'm involved with here is something called muscle activation, where we get the muscles activated before we start to stretch them. And here's something you can try. If you just stand up and just bend forward and try to touch your toes and see how far you get. And then after that, assume like a ready position, like when you're ready to return a serve or if you're playing defense in basketball. Make two fists, put them together, and put them between your bent knees. And then with your knees, squeeze your fists together. So you're doing like an isometric exercise. And then while you're holding and squeezing your hands, rock your knees back and forth 10 times. Then rock back and forth forward 10 times. And then rotate in a circle clockwise 10 times, counterclockwise 10 times. Then put your hands on the outside of your knees and push out against them, holding them in place with an isometric exercise, and repeat, rocking side to side, back and forth, counterclockwise, clockwise, and then try to touch your toes. And I guarantee you, you'll be a few inches longer just by doing that. So we do the muscle activation first, and then we like to do what's called dynamic stretching. And most people will get out and just start to do the static stretchings where they will do like a hurdler stretch or just pull their knee up behind their leg, grab their ankle, or do some stretching. But what we like to do is have you in motion while you stretch. So in other words, one thing is we start off with a good morning walk where you take a step forward, plant your right foot, and lift your back foot up to the horizontal behind you and put your arms out to the side almost like you're an airplane or a stork on one leg and your chest is coming forward so that your leg and chest are parallel with your ground and you're supporting yourself on the vertical right leg. And then you step forward with your left leg and then stand on that where you kick your right leg behind you. And this is a nice stretch for the hamstring. And then we can go on and do what's called a toy soldier where you almost look like a rocket. You put your left arm out in front of you at the horizontal, and you kick your right leg up to touch your left foot. And then you, with your next step, you put your right hand out to the horizontal and kick your left leg up to hit your right hand. And you do this back and forth, back and forth. And then there's a series of other exercises that you can do. But basically what you're doing is stretching your muscles while you're actively moving. And it's a great form of stretching technique. And we have found it to be more efficient because, you know, I don't know if you've read in a lot of the sports training literature the controversy about whether stretching does or does not decrease your risk of injury, whether it does or does not impair performance. And there's been studies that show that stretching before a vertical jump actually decreases your vertical jump. So there's a lot of controversy about whether you stretch. But I can guarantee you that if you do the muscle activation and the dynamic stretching, that you're going to feel looser. And you're going to be less likely to get injured because you're actively moving while you stretch, which is what you would normally do in an activity.
Okay, great. Tomas, hopefully that answers your question. And everybody listening, everybody who sent in questions today, thank you very much for taking the time to give us some great content to work on. And Jack, I want to thank you very much for spending your time with us today. And I appreciate the well thought out answers and the good information. I'm sure that it's going to be a great help to the listeners of the Essential Tennis Podcast.
Well, I hope everyone enjoyed the answers. This has been a lot of fun for me, and you know, you're a great guy. I love listening to your podcast, and you know, hopefully I'll be welcome back, and we get a good response on this initial session.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I'd love to have you back on the show. So everybody listening, if you enjoyed the answers by Dr. Jack Kripsak, send me a quick note. Let me know what you thought. Tell me if it was helpful for you, and tell me if you would like to hear him back on the show again. And if you would like to hear him back on the show and you have a specific question that has to do with tennis and fitness and sports medicine, injuries, anything that we covered today, or any other topic that you would like to have answered by Dr. Jack, send me a quick note. Go to essentialtennis.com and send me a note through the website there. Let me know what you thought of today and tell me if you have any further questions. Well, Jack, again, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure having you on. And hopefully I'll have you back on the show in another couple of weeks.
My pleasure, Ian. And I'm having a great time. This is wonderful. Good luck with your podcast.
All right, great. Well, before we get into answering questions today from listeners about their tennis strokes and strategy and the rest of their game, we're going to have a quick message here from our first sponsor of the Essential Tennis Podcast. As the podcast continues to grow, I'm going to begin looking for sponsors to help offset the cost of hosting the website and also the bandwidth used for the downloads of the podcast. So if you're interested in becoming a sponsor of the Essential Tennis Podcast, simply go to essentialtennis.com and leave me a note using the form on the feedback page. And now here is the sponsor for today's show.
The Essential Tennis Podcast is brought to you by Bridgewater Medical Group is a multi-specialty medical group located in Bridgewater, New Jersey, and is your home for primary care, gastroenterology, sports medicine, and general internal medicine. They offer a broad array of on-site, state-of-the-art services to make your healthcare experience more pleasurable. Schedule appointments are preferred, but physician assistants are available for walk-in care. For more information, call Bridgewater at 908-722-0808. For more information on sponsors of the Essential Tennis Podcast or to become a sponsor, visit www.essentialtennis.com. And now, back to the show.
Okay, time to go on to our questions today from listeners of the podcast. Our first question is from Tina. Tina writes and says, "Ian, could you give me a few pointers on how to place my serve? I have just learned how to use side spin by changing my grip, and I find it harder to place my serve now. Thanks, Tina." Well, Tina, I'm going to assume that the way you learned to hit side spin was by switching to more of a continental grip. Most likely that's the case. And if that's the case and you're swinging across the right side of the ball, I'm going to go ahead and assume you're right-handed as well. You're now hitting the right side of the ball to make the ball spin from the left side of the ball to the right side of the ball, and that's giving you a curve in the ball that's moving from right to left. So most likely, after having changed your grip towards continental and making that side spin serve, you're probably starting to miss more to the left. Hitting side spin is going to cause the ball to curve to the left. And so to adjust for that, you're going to have to start turning your body a little bit more and aiming your swing, the direction that your racket is traveling. You're going to want to start aiming your swing more to the right to account for that curve in the ball. If you just hit a flat serve at the box, straight forwards towards the service box that you're trying to hit, if you hit the ball flat, you can aim straight. And in terms of right to left, and you can aim at the box and hit your target. Now, if you switch to a side spin serve and hit the right side of the ball, you can no longer just aim towards the box because that side spin is going to make the ball go to the left, assuming you're right-handed. If you're left-handed, then that side spin is going to cause the ball to go to your right. And so you can no longer swing in the direction of the box. You're going to have to swing to the side to account for that spin and that curve. So if you're consistently missing to the left, which I'm guessing is probably the case, start making the path of your racket, as you hit the right side of the ball, start moving the path of your racket more to the right so that you will swing a little bit to the right of your target, and the curve on your spin serve is going to bring the ball back to the left to actually hit where you're trying to aim. Hopefully that makes sense. Beyond actually making that technique change, you need to get out and get tons of repetition. With experimentation, you will find where your serves are starting to land now because it's different. You're hitting a different part of the ball, and so now the ball is traveling differently through the air, and you're just going to have to continue to hit and gain experience and learn what the reaction of the ball is now that you're trying to hit a different serve. So the main things you need to do are change the path of your racket a little bit more to the right and get practice. Over on the deuce side, you're going to have to aim kind of down the tee to make the ball go right in the middle of the box. And on the ad side, you're going to have to aim out wide to make the ball go in the middle of the box. I would go out and practice with a hopper of balls and bring a target with you, a cone or just a tennis ball can or whatever, anything that you can physically aim for, and just put it out there in a certain part of the box and figure out, depending on how much spin you put on your serve, where's the ball going to go? And you need to try to start learning to be consistent with putting a certain amount of spin on the ball and therefore having to aim for a certain spot to make the ball go where you want it to go. Hopefully that makes sense. If you need any more help, please definitely let me know. All right, our second question comes from Dean. I love this question. It's about doubles. I love playing doubles, and this is a topic I like to discuss. Dean writes and says, "Here are a couple questions for your podcast. I have participated in league play doubles for a while now and have noticed that my frequency of poaching has gone down over time. More returns are hit cross-court, closer to the net, and with good pace. Lobs have greater height and depth. In short, there are fewer easy net opportunities available, and I only seem to intercept the ball due to an opponent's mishit or miscalculation. Clearly, my net playing skills need to catch up with the baseline skills of my opponents. Could you please provide some advice to help improve my net game?" Sure. And Dean has a second question that I'll get to in a second here. I'll go ahead and talk about that first. Dean, my number one piece of advice for you is just start going. Just start going. Just go for the ball. If it's possible for you to reach, let's say your partner is serving and your opponent is getting ready to hit a return, he's just hit his return. As the ball is coming over towards your side of the court, if it's possible for you to reach it, I want you to go for it. You're doing your partner a favor by going for it. You're the person who's in an aggressive position up at the net. You can make something happen up there at the net. You should be the one going for it if you can reach it. Even if your partner is serving and volleying and coming forwards, which it sounds like he's usually not, but even if he was, you're still the one that's going to be much closer to the net when the ball crosses over to your side of the court. So therefore, if you can reach it, in terms of position, you're the person on your team that can do a lot more with the ball to actually win the point. By letting your partner take it, either your partner is having to hit a much deeper volley on their first shot because they haven't made it all the way in yet, or they're actually letting it bounce and come back up again, and you're giving your opponents all that time where the ball is bouncing, coming back up, where they can get in position and try to put the ball away on you. So I want you to be more proactive. If you can reach the return of serve or any other subsequent shot, that's going across over to your partner's side, I want you to go for it. I want you to be proactive and put pressure on your opponents. If they're able to continue to hit cross court over and over and over, you're letting your opponents get comfortable. You're letting them know by never going, all right, all we have to do against this guy is just hit cross court. Doesn't even matter if it's great, but if we get it cross court, he's just staying home. He's just sitting there and watching the ball go by. And so you're giving them an easy out. You're giving them a shot that they know if they hit it there, then they're safe. And your job as your team's net player, your job as your partner, your job is as a supporting role up at the net is to make your opponents uncomfortable. If they feel for any part during the match that they have a shot that they can hit and they're immediately safe, then you're not doing your job. Now, you mentioned later on in the email, I'll get to it, that you're a 3.0 player. The way I'm speaking to you, the strategy that I'm asking you to implement is the strategy of a pretty high level player, at least a 4.0 or a 4.5 player. But if you want to get to that level, you need to start forcing yourself to put yourself in that position to make things happen, to go for the ball when you're at the net. And I'm not saying, you know, you're having to lay out and dive for the ball and you're just barely touching it. You know, wait for a reasonable shot where you can get to it in time and be relatively comfortable making contact. Now, if you're just not getting those chances at all, then your partner's serve needs to get better, or your partner's ground strokes need to get better. If your partner is hitting such a weak shot that you are never getting an opportunity to reach a return of serve or to reach a ground stroke struck from the person in front of you across the net, they need to start hitting better shots to try to set you up. If your opponents are getting such easy shots, you never have an opportunity to even touch the ball, then your partner needs to do a little bit more to hit a solid shot to give you a chance to go for the ball and put the ball away. However, I would bet that you probably have opportunities, but you're just not seeing them and taking advantage of them. If you can reach it, I want you to go. Okay, on to Dean's second question. He says, one scenario which occurs increasingly often is a long, drawn-out cross-court rally between the baseline players in which the fellow net players are almost turned into spectators. In my 3.0 experience, this point usually ends with an error by a net player, one who got impatient or who fell asleep. Do you have any suggestions on where these players should be positioned or how they should be moving during such a rally? Well, again, you need to start going for the ball. It's not being impatient. It's good strategy. Since you're closest to the net, you should be trying to get to the ball. So it's not being impatient. It's good doubles. If you can reach it, then go for it. Now, if you miss, that's not a matter of the strategy being bad. That's a matter of your technique not being where it should be. And so at that point, if you're going, let's say you go for 10 shots that you have to move for, you get to it and you get your racket on it, but you miss, let's say, 5 out of those 10, or 6 out of those 10. You need to work on the technique of your volleys, and that will build your confidence as you work on putting more volleys in play. That will build your confidence to go for the ball more often. At no point should you be sitting there just watching your partner back at the baseline and your opponent back at the baseline on their side, just rallying back and forth, back and forth. That's poor doubles. And I'm not getting down on you. You know, I'm not saying you're a bad player. That's usually 2.5 and 3.0 and even sometimes 3.5 level doubles. That's how it is. But I don't want you to stay there. I want you to move up in level. So I want you to start going for those shots. And when you do cross and you go for it, I want you to take that volley and put it down at the feet of the net player in front of you on the other side of the court. Don't hit it back to the baseliner. Hit at the net player in front of you. They have no time to react to the shot. And obviously, they're not comfortable with their volleys in the first place, or they would have gone first. So go ahead and hit it right at them or at their feet, and you're going to win that point a very high percentage of the time. Other things I have written down here, get your partner to the net. By your partner staying back, he is giving your opponents an easy way out. When they look up and see your partner sitting back there at the baseline, they know all they have to do is hit it to that half of the court, and they're at least going to be in the point for another shot, because the chances of him hitting a ground stroke and just putting it away from for a winner from behind the baseline at a 3.0 level, that's not going to happen very often. He's not going to hit a big ground stroke and put it away. So by him staying back, he is giving them an easy way out in the point. All they have to do is keep it back to him, and they can stay relatively relaxed. And that's why the net players are falling asleep, because the ground strokers, while they can keep it in play and at least keep it to one half of the court, they're not putting the ball away either. So you need to make something happen up at that net position and start going for the ball to put it away. You don't want your opponents to be comfortable. You don't want them to have a shot that they can take for granted and say, all right, just hit cross court, cross court, cross court. We're safe, we're safe, we're safe. You don't want them to ever feel safe. And so you need to be going for enough shots that they're always wondering in the back of their head, back there at the baseline, is he going to go or not? And that's going to force them to try going down the alley, which is a lower percentage shot. And they're going to be forced to have to try to hit a more aggressive shot cross court. And they're going to start making more mistakes. Plus, you're going to start getting more volleys and putting more balls away. So the combination of those two things is going to tilt the scales in your favor. Rather than sitting there in the middle of the service box and just being a spectator, I want you to get involved in the point as much as possible. Dean, hopefully that answers your question. That's something I feel very strongly about. You know, high-level doubles is people getting to the net as quickly as possible. So if you want to play higher-level doubles, you need to start being more comfortable with making stuff happen up there. And that might mean that you make mistakes for a little while as you start going out of your comfort zone and going for the ball. But in the long run, you will improve your tennis if you start doing what I'm suggesting. Your partners might not appreciate the couple mistakes at first, but don't worry about it. You're not playing at the U.S. Open for the championship. You're out there playing for fun and competing once in a while too. But if you want to continue to move up in level, you need to start making more things happen at the net and try to get your partner up there as well. I could talk about that for a whole hour. Dean, if you have any further questions on that, please let me know. Hopefully that answers your question. And hopefully I'm motivating you to be more active and proactive up there at the net. Okay, our last questions for today come from John. John has a couple questions about strains and his equipment. His first question is, how do you know when it's time to replace strains? Do you just wait until they break? All right, well, that depends, John, on how long it takes for you to break your strains. The general rule of thumb for replacing your strains in your racket is the number of times you play in a week should be around the number of times per year that you replace your strains in your racket. So if you're only playing once or twice a week, then every 6 months is probably fine. If you're playing 3, 4, or 5 times a week, then every couple of months you should probably be replacing your strains, because strains lose their elasticity over time. They get soft and mushy. Over a period of 6 months to a year, they're pretty much going to be bad. So if any of you out there listening haven't strung your racket in the last year, go get it done. And if you're playing many times a week, you should be restraining it every couple of months if you don't break the strains before then. Now, John, if you're playing 3, 4, 5 times a week and you're breaking a strain like once a month or once every 6 weeks, then yes, just go ahead and wait till it breaks. There's no need to strain it before it breaks, unless you need a certain number of rackets to go play a match and you have to have a backup and maybe one or two of your rackets are getting close to breaking a strain. Then at that point, go and get it done to make sure that you have the proper amount of equipment to go play your match. But if they're breaking before you're playing with them for, you know, a couple months, then just wait for it to break, and that's fine. John continues and says, "Also, since I've started stringing my own rackets, I've learned that there's actually a procedure to cut strings to minimize the stress on the frame. If that's actually a concern, is it a problem to leave a single broken string in your racket for several hours while you finish a match? Should I always carry a wire cutter or something with me to cut all the strings when one actually breaks on me?" John, that's a good question. No, that's not necessary. Now, most current frames are going to be strong enough that if a single string breaks, that does put a little bit of extra pressure on the frame, one way or the other. Meaning, if a main string breaks, one of the strings that goes up and down parallel to the handle, then those strings lose tension, whereas the cross strings, the ones that run perpendicular to the racket, most of those strings are going to have full tension still. So that's going to put a little bit of stress on the racket. It's going to squeeze the frame in from 9 and 3 o'clock. It's going to be putting a little bit more pressure than normal because you don't have the full tension on the main strings to balance out the tension on the frame. However, if it's just for a couple hours, or even if it's just for a day or two, frames nowadays are strong enough that you don't have to worry about it. It's not going to break your racket. What I would definitely say that you should not do, however, since you're stringing your own rackets, if you're stringing up the mains on your racket, the ones that are parallel to the handle, and let's say you get a phone call or all of a sudden you have to leave, I would not leave a frame on the strainer with only half of the racket done. If you have all the mains done and the racket's just sitting there, don't leave it for a couple hours before you do the crosses, the ones that run perpendicular. That's a case where there's a lot of extra pressure there since there's no strings at all to support the other direction on the frame. That's a situation where you could actually bend or warp the frame. I've only seen that happen once or twice, even in that situation, where a careless strainer has left a racket on the straining machine with only half the strings done, and that will actually bend a frame, it will actually warp a frame. However, once you release the tension, it'll usually just go back to its normal shape. Moral of the story is, if you break a single string, no. Most of the tension is going to be retained throughout the rest of the racket, and so it's not a huge deal. It's not going to break your racket or bend it. When you go home later that day, it would probably be a good idea to cut at least one cross string, at least one of the other direction of strains to even it out. But it's not a huge deal where you have to cut all of them immediately or else you're going to hurt your racket. There's just not that much tension going one way or the other when only one string has been broken. Hopefully that answers your question fully. I've definitely left rackets with one string or two or even three strings broken in my bag for, probably a week at a time. And I've never had a racket get warped or bent. So it's not something you have to worry about. Thanks for the question, John. And if you need any other help, please let me know. Okay, that does it for episode number 12 of the Essential Tennis Podcast. A couple quick reminders here at the end of the show. Sign up for the Essential Tennis newsletter at EssentialTennis.com. Again, that will give you first information on new content that's up, both in the podcast and the different blogs and all the other great information for you guys there. So go to EssentialTennis.com to sign up to that. Also, I'd love to hear feedback from any of you guys about Dr. Jack Kripsak. Let me know if you liked the content that he had for you guys, if you thought it was helpful to you. And if it was helpful to you and you have any questions you'd like him to answer in a couple weeks, please send me those questions as well. Also, anybody else who has questions about their game, you're always welcome to send me a note through EssentialTennis.com. Simply go to the feedback page and fill out the form there. I'd love to hear from you. and I'd love to help you with your game. Every time you ask me a question and I answer it on the podcast, it helps numerous other people out there that are listening and have the same issue. So it's not only going to help your game, but it'll help the community as well. So if you have a question for Dr. Jack or a question for me about your tennis, head on over to EssentialTennis.com. Send that over to me. And together as a community, we'll all continue to grow in our understanding and in our skill as tennis players. Lastly, those of you who have purchased books through the website Mental Tennis, and those of you who have earned a free set of Strain through leaving me a comment on the iTunes Music Store, all of those things were sent out this morning. I finally got a chance to go over to the post office. So if you've had a free set of Strain coming to you, or if you have purchased a book from me, that'll be coming in a couple days. You'll get that later on this week. And I hope that you enjoy whatever you got from me. Remember to go to the website if you'd like to purchase Mental Tennis by Vic Braden. And again, the next three people who make an order will also receive a free set of Strain. All right, that's it for today. Thank you very much for tuning in. I appreciate everybody who's taken the time to download and listen to the podcast. Best of luck to you and your tennis. Definitely let me know if I can help you in any way. So take care this week, and good luck with your tennis.